Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. Today, we've got very special guest, Stan Bush. Hey, Stan, how are you?
Hey, doing great. How's it going?
Good, good. We're getting cold here in New Jersey.
Oh, well, yeah, not too bad here, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure. So what I wanted to start talking about tonight was you've got the brand new box set that you're selling, which I actually just purchased my copy this past weekend. But let's talk a little bit about that box set. How did that whole idea come about?
It was maybe 3 years ago or so. I realized that I'd, you know, had enough albums to make a nice box set, and I organized, and the printer, you know, we got the artwork for it, and a print guy printed them up and all that, and So, it's done real well. People like it. It's like my whole life in this box. I mean, I'm really proud of it. It's some of my, you know, most of my best work there and, over the years. And anyway, but thank you. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. Looking forward to my copy there.
He liked it so much. He went out and bought it.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's great.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about was included in that box set is your latest album, right?
Yes.
And that's the 2020 release, which is Dare to Dream. I was just been listening to that myself the last few days. And I mean, it's a really strong album. I got to congratulate you on that. It's got like about five or six songs that I'm really digging on right from like first listen. And, you know, I keep getting more and more into them as I'm going, listening to it repeatedly.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really happy with how it came out. It's funny. I had heard this from other bands and things I'd read that COVID was in a way sort of a, you know, silver lining in the cloud there about as far as creatively. You know, they were able to come up with some really neat great songs and things during that time because everybody was sort of shut in. And anyway, it was it worked out well. My producer he's my best friend, guitar player he's from Germany originally, but Holger Pfaff, he did a great job. He's produced my last six albums or so.
Oh, wow.
And so about half of the box set are ones that he worked with me on, and that it came out really good. And I like all the songs a lot.
Yeah.
But thank you. It's called Dare to Dream, that album. Yeah.
Dare to Dream. Yeah. I mean, there's song, like the one song, The 80s is a real great anthem.
That was fun. Yeah, we did a music video for that.
Yeah. Dream Big was another real big favorite of mine. The Times of Your Life, I really dig on Never Give Up. Home, the last track on the album. It's a great song.
Thank you. Yeah, that one's fun. Yeah.
Yeah, really enjoyed that one. So it was real nice to... Do you think, like, because that came out late 2020, I mean, I honestly... And I got to tell you, and I'll be honest, I wasn't really aware of the album when it came out, and only kind of got turned on to it more recently. Do you think, obviously, because of COVID, the world being shut down, it didn't really get a fair shake?
Oh, I hadn't really thought about that. It's one of those, you know, I don't know. It got good reviews and everything. So
okay, it just went over my radar.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's. You just put it out and just try to focus on the creative side. But I'm actually very close to having another one ready. I've been working all since then. I usually write, you know, a a few songs each year, and I write and record them as I go along. So it's getting really close to having, you know, I got, I think, 10 songs now, and there's a couple of movie possibility things that are coming up. I don't want to get into those, but just, you know, we'll just see. But I think it'll probably be in the first half of, or at least during 2025 for the new release. Yeah.
Great. Wow.
The new songs are really good. So.
Oh, wow. Great. Looking forward to that for sure.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Barrage album, to go back in a little bit of time. I think some artists have a certain album that over the course of time really defines their career. And for me, that was my initial inception of finding out about you as an artist. And it's turned out to be decades of being a Stan Bush geek trying to collect. And by the way, collecting everything you ever done is a very daunting task. But if you could take us back to that album, which has now become a very, even over the passage of decades, a really iconic album. How did that band come together? How did those songs come together? How did that whole album come together?
Yeah, that was actually my second album. Right. I did a solo album for CBS just with my name. But the second one was, I was signed to Scotti Brothers, and they were distributed by Epic Records. And anyway, the song Love Don't Lie, I had written that one already, and that was part of the reason that I got signed, was the producer loved that song. And the producer, he worked with Kiss and a bunch of people, and so it was really a top-notch album recording-wise. We had some great players, and he was also the producer, Richie Wise. He got me hooked up with some really good writers, and that's when I met Lenny Macaluso. We co-wrote The Touch, and let's see, what else? There's a couple more songs on that album, but since then we've written, you know, scores of songs, and he and I are still real tight. We work together on a lot of the newer songs too. But yeah, The Touch was in the Transformers movie, the original one, Transformers the movie,
it's the animated one, right?
Animated, yeah. And like I say, the Touch and Dare was the other song on the album, on the movie, I mean. And they both did really well. And like I say, that seemed to be my signature song. And there were other, you know, a lot of really good songs on that album. But I remember that Richie, he told me, he said, "I want to make the best rock and roll album ever made." Great.
Well, I mean, it's held up on those levels. So, I mean, it's, you know, yeah.
I think it was voted number 13 of all albums. This was on Kerrang magazine in England. Yeah. So it really has held up, and sonically it's great. It's, you know, Neve console and Studer, you know, 24 track, you know, tape machine.
A nice analog sound.
The engineer was great. So the musicians were all really good. They've all played in a bunch of other stuff and with people and things. And it's, thank you.
You talk about it. I mean, you had Pat Torpey, who obviously went on to play with Mr. Big, but played with Robert Plant. You had Rocket Rashad on guitar.
Hey, Rocket. Rocket's great.
Oh yeah. I got to see him with David Lee Roth in the '90s.
Oh yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah, but a great band, and just great songs. Like Tom said, I mean, it's something that held up. I mean, we'd be remiss if we didn't kind of talk about or touch on the song "The Touch." Obviously, that was in, you know, you mentioned 1986, the Transformers animated movie. How did that, like, you know, that was something you had written, not even thinking about movies, or how did that come about?
Yeah, we wrote it, myself and Lenny. We wrote it with the movie, Stallone movie, Cobra, in mind. And we were, you know, it was just a shot, right? And then the record company tells me this, we got it in this animated movie about robots. And I'm like, oh, really? Anyway, but little did I know that it would turn out to be a big phenomenon. You know, the Transformers, the whole brand has since that time has just gotten more popular. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
They're coming up on the 40th anniversary too.
Wow.
It was 1986, and that'll be, 25 is just around the corner. And then, so, they're already gearing up. I think Hasbro they reached out to me about possibly doing some shows and things. And
oh wow,
it's fun. I go to the conventions and Transformers sort of geeks, I guess. But I guess all of us are geeks.
Exactly.
Right.
Oh yeah. No, I fully admit that.
If you see what I have in front of me and
piles of CDs,
the Jap pressings, the Euro pressings I had to get because there were two songs that weren't on the Jap pressings. And
oh, that's great.
So what I wanted to ask you about Barrage also, just is just like a mindset of the creation of that album. I always liken Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet album in 86 to be like the album that kind of like, I hate to use the term, but the hair band, the classic hair, what became the hair band sound. Was your writing in 87 for this album to kind of fit in with that, what was that bludgeoning American scene at that time? Because it kind of had a very similar type of sound of what was coming out in the States at that time. It's a lot different from your debut album.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think I remember when that song was out. It was when we were recording the Barrage album. I remember seeing the music video on MTV. It was like, wow, this is a great song. You know, Living on a Prayer is still one of the all time classic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole album, and I always
Rocky
just...
song too. You know, Rocky for you know, Eye of the Tiger. Eye of the Tiger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. We had Dave Bickler on the show a couple of years ago.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's a nice guy. I toured with them in the 90s and opening for them in Europe and Germany.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, the band, actually the photo of the guys in, you know, Pat Torpy and Rocket and the keyboard player, Rick Serrate, he went on to play with Whitesnake and a bunch of other people. And also the, the bass player who toured with Rick Springfield, Mike Seifert. Anyway, all those guys were in the photo, and it was really, honestly, we got some guys together and took a picture, and that was in the CBS parking lot garage.
Really?
So it has an urban sort of appeal. And by the way, I really wanted to buy that lavender leather jacket, but it was at the time I didn't have the money. It was like $400 or something. That was a fortune back then. But anyway, so it wasn't really a band. We just kind of got some guys together and shot a picture, but
oh wow,
photo shoot.
Well, that jacket like made an impression on me when I bought the album. I was like, that's some jacket, and it was like really like again like the that was the beginnings of like that hair band scene where like something like that, like people saw that and was like, yeah, I connected with that jacket. You know, like where did this guy get this jacket from?
I think they rented it.
Really.
Yeah, a lot of photo shoots, they do that. They rent clothes.
Yeah.
Rick and Rag, I think, was the company. But it's funny, I remember all this stuff because it was so long ago.
Well, it's funny because you just mentioned the bass player, Mike. I actually saw Rick Springfield last month.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually going to sing with him. He's about to go on tour, and he was going to record some background vocals. And so he called me up the other day, and yeah, so I sang on a couple of his albums, and he's a nice guy. We did an AT&T wireless commercial years ago too. I sang, kind of doubled him on the Jesse's Girl thing, you know.
So how'd you get involved in all that stuff? Because you obviously have that long history, obviously not just the movie soundtrack stuff, but you've done a lot of like jingles, commercials, things like that. How did that whole thing become? How did you get into that?
Well, just through musician friends. I did Toyota and Coors Beer and a bunch of stuff. And during the late 80s, early 90s, I was one of the main guys, you know, that did rock stuff and jingles. And it pays well. It's very cool.
We just had a guy, I don't know if you know John Fiore, the name.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember the name.
We just had him on last couple weeks ago on the show. Yeah. So, and he talked about it. He did the Folgers commercials and the Diet Coke and all that stuff.
Yeah, it was a great living. I mean, I did that. That was around the time also when I did the Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. I sang three songs in each of the first two movies, Bloodsport and a kickboxer.
Okay. But yes.
That was part of the, I was kind of a session singer. I sang on Alice Cooper's album and Jefferson Starship and a bunch of things. Won an Emmy during the 90s. So
nice.
It's kind of, LA is like kind of a weird town. You know, it's like, I know a lot of musicians, they're all buddies of mine, and you know, some of them will go out, they have REO Speedwagon or Elton John or whatever, you know, these guys are the best, you know, they play with everybody.
Yeah.
So they rattle off all these people they've played with and, oh, I can't hold a job. Huh?
And by the way, that Bloodsport soundtrack that has the actual songs that you sang is very difficult to find. I finally found somebody that had it on CD, because there's actually two different versions. There's like a score of it that doesn't have the songs with you, and then there's another version that does, and that version that has your songs is very hard to find.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's good stuff though.
Fight to Survive is a great song. I mean, that, now when you record those songs, are you not able to put them on your albums?
I was a hired singer on that stuff. I didn't write those songs, but let's see, we got Fight to Survive was in a couple of Fox shows. It was the animated show. It was around the time when The Simpsons and all that stuff.
Okay, so they've used it on other programs too.
Yeah, some of these other shows, American Dad had The Touch, and so you know.
Right. Okay.
But sometimes they reach out to me for those things, and I, you know, I can, you know, steer them in the right direction to get to license the song, you know. So.
Well, I think the Goldbergs used The Touch too, right?
Goldbergs, yeah, that was another one.
I remember that. That episode and the Weird Al one.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I know Weird Al. He's a good guy.
We had that kind of that single when The Touch came out, right, from the movie. It had the double single with the Weird Al song in yours.
That'd be stupid. That was on the soundtrack of the Transformers movie.
Yeah.
Now, after the first Stan, Bush, and Barrage, was your intention to do like a part two of that, or were you already looking to go more in a solo direction, which you obviously did go?
Yeah, it's weird because that was always, I was always a band guy, right? Through all the years of playing, but that Touch song did really well, and I sort of had a following in Europe and Japan and in the UK, and it just sort of, I just kind of stayed a solo artist. From there on, I always thought, you know, maybe I should have done a band thing, you know, like Whitesnake is just it's really just David Coverdale, right? Mm-hmm. And he's, I guess he owns the name or something, but I don't know. It just kind of worked out that way. It was never my intention to be a solo artist, period, you know, but it just sort of worked out that way.
Because it kind of seemed like after the 90, 91 period passed, when things started to change in the States, that you kind of, like, unlike a lot of artists, got like a big following in Europe and Japan and had like a lot of releases. And is that kind of like the way things, how did it progress that Europe and Japan became such strongholds for you?
That's a great question. I think early 90s, 91, that's around the time rock, mainstream rock or 80s rock kind of imploded. There was no more, like you said, hair bands, that kind of corporate rock or whatever sort of went away, and the grunge thing came in, and it was all, you know, just a different vibe. And but I still had a following in Europe and Japan, and I just focused on that. You know, I kept making recordings and music and releasing stuff. Around that time, I wrote with Jonathan Cain. When Journey broke up, we talked about maybe doing a band. Also, Foreigner, I had auditioned for Foreigner as a singer.
Wow.
When Lou Gramm left the band. And so anyway, it's a bunch of stuff like that. And did some tours and things in Europe. And it just kind of, I was able to keep doing what I did, you know, because mainstream rock was still popular in Europe and Japan. And in the States, it kind of wasn't, you know, and there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, business there for me, you know, at my style of music. I also, during that later 90s, I kind of went more more acoustic a little bit. I kind of went, you know, towards maybe like a Don Henley vibe or something, mm-hmm. just for a bit, and realized that the rock was really my roots. So I kind of got back to that, but in the 2000s.
Well, I even hear that on the last track on the newest album from 2020, Home, which I mentioned before. That's kind of got that almost like singer songwriter sort of feel to it.
Right. Yeah, yeah. There was another one that I did on the In This Life album. It was about kind of about growing up in Florida. That's where I'm from. And it's a song called Southern Rain. And it's about not just about walking in the rain and all that, but about, you know, childhood and things and reflecting back. And it's a nice song, that one.
Mm. So. Now, do you attribute the success of Barrage for what turned out to be the success in Europe and Japan? Because at the time in the early 90s, I wrote for a couple of UK magazines, one of which was a magazine called Boulevard, which was run by a guy by the name of Mark Ashton that did Now and Then Records.
I remember Mark Ashton.
Right. And I remember he was like very plugged into you. And then I started writing for you. And everybody in the UK especially was very plugged into Stan Bush. And do you think it was solely because of that album, or was there anything on your part that you feel like as you as an artist, how do you think you got that rabid following from these countries?
I think that, you know, largely it was that album. You know, I did a lot of good stuff after that, but that was sort of that was a high bar at that point, you right. know, to also without you know, a substantial budget, you know, it's hard to get that big sound, you know. But nowadays, like I say, my producer Holger Pfaff, he gets great sounds just in his home studio. So you can make a record on a decent, you know, smaller budget now and still get the high quality. I mean, the album budgets back in the 80s were just incredible. I mean, like you spend 150, 200 grand on an album. Sure. And that's just for sort of a debut artist. If you were, you know, I don't know, you'd hear stuff like, I don't know, some of these big bands, they spend like, you know, millions recording an album. It's crazy.
And then the artists get the bill for all that. We just had a couple of guys that had big budget hair band guys on recently. They all tell us the same thing. We thought we made a lot of money until we got the bill for all the studio time and realized we were in arrears to the record company.
Right. That's exactly right. That's what happened. And the deals too were structured that way. You know, it was a record company would get the lion's share of the profit, and a lot of times the artist wouldn't make hardly anything.
Yeah.
And it was it's not like I said, unless you're like super famous, it's you don't really do that well. And I think most bands make a large part of their money touring and merchandise and all that, you know.
Yeah. Well, and going back into the 80s, you could do two words. You could say recoupable expense, right?
Yeah. It's weird, too, because the internet turned out to be sort of a double-edged sword in that regard. I mean, remember that whole thing where the illegal downloading and all that stuff, when they mm-hmm. started doing that, it was like, you know, you would think, okay, you spend like 50, 100 grand recording an album, and then people just get to steal it. They get it for free,
right?
Because of the downloading stuff. And anyway, what was the name of that company that started that?
Napster, was it?
Napster.
Yeah.
And I knew that was going to be sort of the beginning of the end for the.
It really was. That more than anything else.
That was the main.
Yeah.
And then Apple sort of, revolutionized music. And it's weird because they don't even put CD players in cars anymore. So,
USB ports and all that stuff, right?
The Jeep. My Jeep has I got a brand new Jeep and it has a US. I think it's the only American car that still makes the port, because I have the old school iPods and I put all my music on there. And then my last car didn't have that. But
I got the USB.
Yeah. You have it too?
I got one in my Kia.
Okay. There you go.
That's great.
Well, when we talk about digital releases and stuff, there's something, and I was talking with Tom about this before we went on with you. I read in your bio, 2010, your first digital-only release called Heat of the Battle. What is that? Is that a single or is that an album?
It was initially a single, and then it wound up putting on the next album. I forget which album. Might have been The Ultimate. I can't remember.
Okay. So it was just a song. It was a digital.
It was just release. That song. Gotcha. Yeah, okay.
Okay. I thought I missed something.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of things like that where I'd release a single ahead of time and then and on the next, like the 80s was the like 80s, that.
Yeah.
We did a music video and then put out a single. The long-haired guy in the beginning plays a young me in the video. He's like supposed to be me looking back, you know, remembering back. And then, you know, there's like a, we rented a VW bus. So it had the whole sort of 80s, vibe.
Vintage,
you know,
looking vibe. Back.
Yeah.
So that's all on your website, right? StanBush.com. Everybody can check that out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, basically, as a songwriter and a prolific one at that, and obviously the many solo albums you've had over the years and other projects and stuff, but I wanted to ask you about the art of songwriting. How do you approach that? Like, because even I can kind of fast forward to the Dare to Dream, the 2020 release. And I mean, we talked about the 80s a couple times, but even songs like Never Give Up, The Time of Your Life and stuff, they have this theme, which is, you know, I could hear them in movies and TV shows and stuff like that. How do you approach songwriting? Do you look at it like you're writing that style? Like, do you have that style where you're like, I want to write an anthem, or is this just natural for you?
Well, one of the things I guess I should start with, I loved 80s movies and those songs from the 80s. Like we were talking about, like Eye of the Tiger, songs like that. And That's What Dreams Are Made Of, you know, the mm-hmm. Van Halen, I mean, all those kinds of songs, that like anthems. I love that stuff. And you'd come out of the movie theater and, you know, humming the song or singing the song, you'd remember it, right? And the anthem is also sort of 80s style songwriting. I mean, bands like, you know, Heart and all these, you know, Jefferson Starship, I mentioned them. They have these, the songwriting is a real craft. They have the, you know, the verse, a chorus, a lot of times there's a bridge between, our B section we called it, and then it would be, you'd find a really catchy melody, and it would be a memorable melody that you stick in your head, and you're like, it's kind of hard to describe how I write songs, but it's just like you start with the lyric or the music, and for me it's the music. I play a few chords on guitar, and then, then like a melody will emerge, and I'll think, oh, this is cool. And then it's something you have to just fall in love with. For me, it is. If I don't love something, I don't even finish it. You know, it's just sort of, I've got a bunch of little pieces of songs, ideas and things, but yeah, it's sort of like, whether you do the music or the lyrics first, it's kind of the chicken or the egg, and people do it differently. But for me, the melody is a big part of it, and having that memorable hook. And it's hard also, you gotta have a sense for, okay, this is cheesy, I'll go this direction instead. You know, you gotta sort of have it's really hard to write a good song, but you know it when you hear it, kind of thing. Like everybody, like take a song like Heart of the Matter, Don Henley. I mean, that's one of the best songs ever. And or Africa, you know, killer songs. But I mean, everybody recognizes a great song when they hear it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's a taste thing. And it's one of those things, I'll have a dry spell and I won't write anything for months. But then just a couple weeks ago, got a killer new song, and it's called Invincible. So that's, we're recording that now. Anyway, it's just one of those things. I think mainly it's just coming up with a unique melody, something that sticks in your head. And then also you don't want to copy and put out the same, like a lot of, I change keys a lot too. So if you do everything like really simple, and it's hard to write a simple song, let me say that, I like songs where there's like a modulation key change kind of thing. And anyway,
Yeah.
Def Leppard was they were kings of that stuff. You know, they would the song would go into a different key and like, wow, you know.
Well, I hear that a little bit in the song the 80s that you did.
Yeah, for instance.
I'm
almost thinking,
I'm like, oh, that could be like a Def Leppard song.
A bit, yeah. No, but it's but thank you. I appreciate, you know, you saying that. I mean, I think I don't consider myself, you know, that good of a writer, but I keep on pushing until I come up with something good, and it takes a while, but it's hard to describe how to do it. It's kind of a puzzle, you know?
Mm. Are you the type of person that do you keep like a notebook of like song ideas and you'll go back to them?
I do some, yeah. But like you'll sort of repurpose an old title liner or something, you know, also you were talking about the vibe earlier, how you feel when you hear the songs. That I've always been a real positive person, and like the anthem thing, like you said, and it's like uplifting and powerful at the same time. Like the touch, you know, you're saying the message that, you know, that each of us has the power to do great things, and you know what I mean. It's like, yeah, we sort of make our own reality in a way, and I really believe that. You know, it's like I've gotten fan mail and things, and you know, from people that like those songs changed their life or something, you know, like the Touch and Dare, like from the Transformers movie.
If memory serves me correct, Dirk Diggler sang the Touch at one time.
who did?
Dirk Diggler.
Oh yeah. It was funny. Yeah. Mark Wahlberg. I met him backstage at a Transformers convention, maybe like 5 years ago.
Really?
And yeah, he had just done a panel, right? And he was coming backstage. I had done something, a show that's a concert there too. And he came walking through the backstage area, and I said, "You got the Touch." He turned around. "How did I do?" And I said, "It was great." And he about a couple minutes later, he comes back with his iPhone, and the two of us sing together the Touch like a couple of drunk guys. And anyway, he puts it on his social media, and
that's,
you know,
that's priceless.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
I actually got to see you at the Melodic Rock Fest that Andrew McNeese put on and back in Illinois in one of the versions.
Oh,
there.
Wow. Yeah. That was in Chicago?
Chicago area. Yeah. I mean, I actually was fortunate enough to attend all five shows that he put on over the years. I'm not sure what you were, 2000, maybe 16, 15, something like that.
Yeah. Something like that.
But I was there. I mean, I was at all of them. So I definitely remember seeing you. I just couldn't tell you which show it was, but I definitely saw you.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, it's cool. It's, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, keep doing what I do. The other thing too is some of the songs have sort of a spiritual component. Like all of us are finding our way, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff. But you know, there's so many things that we, you know, can do if we put our mind to it, and you know, you realize that there is a higher power, and you know. We're all learning how to be better people and all that. But I'm just saying, I like to have things that are like uplifting.
Yeah.
That's word. I think Home has that. There's a line in that song, Home, that you like was, how come the child can see so much clearer than when we're grown? Love with your heart, be who you are, see the light you've always known. Of course, that, you know, with the light, of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, that's great stuff. You know, it's like, I believe that stuff, you know.
Well, we had
more in my old age.
Well, we had Kevin Chalfant on recently.
Yeah.
And From the Storm, of course. But he talked to me even on his one solo album, and he kind of went in that little bit of a spiritual direction, right?
Yeah. That's great.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the album Every Beat of My Heart. That's one of How did that album come about? Because that's one of your earlier albums that kind of started to break big in that UK early 90s period of time.
Yeah. That was actually, after the Barrage album, it was a collection of songs, demos that I had recorded with, Jonathan Cain, Jim Vallance, who co-wrote all the Bryan Adams hits, and, Aerosmith as well. He wrote with them, but, Jim Vallance is also a great writer. And of course, Jonathan Cain, and Every Beat of My Heart, I wrote with Brett Tuggle. He was the keyboard player for David Lee Roth at the time. And anyway, the thing about, like I was going to say, Jonathan Cain and Jim Vallance, that struck me about both of those guys, they're both very great writers. But the biggest thing I noticed is that they work. They'll spend 10, 12 hours a day in the studio. Just, you know what I mean? You just grind it out. And that's what you have to do. You have to really push yourself and to make, and then you end up with something great. And it's like.
Now, if there was going to be a second Stan Bush Barrage in the States and a big budget on a big label, would this have pretty much been it, this album?
The new
every
album?
Beat of My Heart. If there was a follow-up to Barrage and you were still on a big label in the States, say in 90, yeah. Would this album have kind of these type of songs? Would that have been what it would sounded like?
Probably, yeah. I mean, that was the stuff I was doing then. And those were good songs, I remember.
I think it's one of the, even if all these studio albums, I think it's one of your stronger ones.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a really high stuff, you know, singing up in the stratosphere.
Yeah, no, it was great stuff.
Oh, thank you. But yeah, I've been very fortunate. It's the drummer from Tom Petty, Stan Lynch, he was my friend for years. We played together in about three different bands back in Florida. And I knew Tom Petty too when we were kids and like eighth grade and stuff. But anyway, Stan told me one time, he said that no matter what you do, he says, always work with the best people you can, you know? And that was a really good thing to remember.
Yeah.
But I've been very fortunate in that regard. A lot of talented people.
Now, another album I really liked a lot was The Child Within. That was an album, one of those albums that you had to buy the UK version because there was a Jap version, but with different titles and different songs. And how did that whole, because that was like a challenging time for a fan to try to get all your stuff because there was a lot of different releases in Japan and the UK. And was that with varying labels that wanted to, I'm guessing, I mean, you could tell me if I'm wrong.
Right. It was a separate label in Japan and a separate label in Europe. In the Europe, it was on BMG and in Germany, and the one called The Child Within.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny it how language translates. He was like, somebody asked me, one of the German guys asked me, "The Child Within what?" You know what I mean? You know, like American, you say the Child Within.
Right.
It's like. You know what I mean? It's just
totally.
Literally taking it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Child Within What?
Child Within What?
Right. Anyway, but the Japanese version was an earlier, like before we remixed it, and it had like Higher Than Angels was on there, and that it was another song that was different. Oh, the one I won the Emmy for, Till I Was Loved by You. That was before we got Robin Beck to do a duet with me on that.
Oh.
Yeah, and then it was the Stan Bush, the Japanese release on Zero at the time called Call to Action.
Yep, Call to Action.
Yeah, and that was another one, yeah.
Yeah, so it's crazy, you know, just one of those things, you know, you get like a release in Europe and Japan, sometimes like... you know, you do one label that would cover both of them, you know, or whatever. But it was really since just my first two albums were ones where I was on major international label, right? So, but then, like I say, once the music business changed so much and sort of, you know, it became like, they have this CD Baby is like a, basically like a record company. So anybody with a computer can be their own record company sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think for me, I wanted to try to keep the quality way up and just like as though I was doing a big budget record, you know. But that's it's been challenging over the years.
You were one of the few AOR artists through the 90s that kept the attention of the Japanese because as the Japanese moved into the middle 90s, they became very metal, you know, like they became very fixated on metal. And a lot of the AOR guys, at least with the Japanese artists getting deals, kind of fell by the wayside. And you were one of the few that were able to still get Japanese deals and a UK deal or a European deal.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's I think like some of the bands, they really like, the Japanese really like Toto. That was one of the
yes, there. Absolutely. I mean, from the late '70s.
Yeah. But I love that stuff. I mean, one of my favorite bands was Foreigner. I mean, Lou Gramm was like an amazing singer in that time period. He was like, nobody could touch him in my mind. Great, great singer.
Who were your what influenced you to get into music, like on like a serious level?
I was always like playing in nightclubs throughout the South. Like I said, I grew up in Florida, and then we'd play gigs all around the South, the Carolinas and Georgia and all that. And then there was a recording group that formed in Colorado with couple of guys I knew from Gainesville, Florida, and they asked me to join, and it was a band called Boulder. Well, initially it was called Helix, but then we changed our name to Boulder. We spent like 3 years in Colorado recording in the mountains, and we got a deal on Elektra Records and came to LA. That was in 79. I'm giving my age away here. Anyway, we did that album. Nothing really happened with it, and the band kind of broke up after that. But that was that got me out here, and then I started recording. I did a sort of a secret album project at Elektra Studios in the old Doors studio, and that became the demo that got me the deal with Columbia. So it was always that thing where if I knew then what I know now, but it was crazy. I mean, the record deal took like 4 or 5, 6 months to negotiate, and the lawyer got most of the money from the advance. You know what I mean? So, right? It's just, silly. Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
Now, oddly enough, on Boulder, you were not the lead singer. It was a gentleman by the name of Bob Harris who went on to sing in Axe, a couple of other bands. At what point did you want to step, or did you always envision yourself as stepping forward as a lead singer?
That's a great question too. It was just around that time. I mean, he was the main singer though. And I didn't really think anything about it. We were all good friends and all that. And I was thinking about calling Bob up the other day. I haven't seen him since back then, but he was working with Frank Zappa for a while. And I don't know what he's doing now, except I guess he's still with Bobby Barth and the X, that band. Bob was, they got after the band broke up, they got offered to go on tour with Warren Zevon. So as his backup band.
And I didn't know that he sang with him.
Yeah. So that's when I started recording my first solo stuff.
He's a terrific singer.
Oh, great singer.
Yeah.
Cool stuff.
Anything.
For yeah. I mean, I could, I know Stan is a little pressed for time and I could go on for hours, and I won't. I think I've covered, enough.
Well, before we let you go, Stan, I wanted to throw a couple names. I've never done this before, and I just came up with this idea the other day. I had a couple names written down. I wanted to throw them at you. Maybe you could just give us your thoughts on them. One of them you mentioned a little bit ago, Jim Vallance. I actually just got to see Bryan Adams earlier this year playing in concert. But the name Jim Vallance, talk a little bit about, thoughts on him.
Oh, he's a terrific guy. Went up to write with him in Vancouver. It's where he lives. And he'd written all those Bryan Adams hits. And I'm like, wow, this guy was Bryan Adams. I mean, some of the melodies it's incredible and just a really good songwriter and nice guy. We wrote together a couple times He also wrote with Aerosmith, he's good buddies with Steven Tyler and all that. And what was the other name?
The other name I'm going to throw at you is Giorgio Moroder.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Giorgio is really talented, too. He had just done the Top Gun soundtrack, and he was writing something for, I forget what it was. I think it was for the soccer championship or something, but he brought me in as a hired singer, and it was something I sang for him as a demo, but I did meet him, and it was funny. What always struck me is that song from Top Gun, Take My Breath Away, mm-hmm. right? And he's Giorgio Moroder, I guess is German or whatever. He's European anyway. But just the way that song was approached is like Americans, we would sing like Take My Breath Away, right? And it would be stupid and not catchy, but Take My Breath Away. It's like, wow, you know, it was a great song because of the phrasing. And it was just, you know, sort of unusual. That always struck me that, you know, I noticed things like that.
But, yeah. What was that? That was Berlin?
Yes.
Berlin sang that song, right?
Yeah.
Another name I'm going to throw at you, and this is a Jersey guy who, unfortunately, we lost not too long ago, but Jack Ponti.
Oh, Jack Ponti. I didn't know he passed.
Yeah, just a few months ago.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, we wrote, I'm trying to remember who introduced us. I think it was through Jonathan Cain. But yeah, I went to Jersey, South Jersey, and wrote with him and another fella. And we recorded like three songs, and then I came back again and we did three more songs. But he was working with that band. I guess he had some stuff he had done with Bon Jovi initially, mm-hmm. but then there was another band called Skid Row.
Sure.
And he was involved in writing for them. But Jack Ponti.
Yeah. Guy. I always wish a guy I always wish I could have interviewed, you know, I know he had such a unique personality, and, you know, a guy that had, again, wrote with so many people, but, you know, just a big unique figure in the music industry.
Yeah. That's funny. I hadn't thought of him in a long time, but yeah, we came up with some good stuff. There was one song called Heaven that, was on the title song from the Heaven album that was released in the UK as part of the CD package. But,
okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about that because a cult band that probably a lot of people don't know about, the name of Aircraft, did a phenomenal cover of that song.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'll have to check it out. Yeah.
You should. It was your song. Yeah. It's on their third album.
Oh, okay,
I'll check it out. Aircraft in the Red.
Oh
yeah.
What a ride. It's been a great ride. You know, it's cool to I moved out of LA finally when about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years, but so lived between LA and San Diego, and it's great, and still doing my stuff and writing and recording.
And also Brett Walker had covered some of your songs, so another artist that I liked a lot.
What a sad thing. Yeah,
yeah, Brett. Terrible. He was a tremendously talented guy, and he covered some of your stuff.
Yeah, yeah. He Hard to Find an Easy Way.
Yep.
That was that one together. And yeah, that was a tragedy. What a great guy and a great talent.
I guess if we do a part two of this podcast, it'll be everybody that covered your songs and all your soundtrack songs. I'm serious. That would be a great part.
Let's do that sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said before, I should mention this before we sign off is, you know, check out stanbush.com and, you know, see what's happening. And there should be a new album coming up very soon.
That's great. That's great news.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you that. I was going to say, give us your socials. We'll share that on our website when we post this episode. And yeah, I was going to ask you about what's coming up in 25, but you told us. So we'll all look forward to new music.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys.
Thank you, Stan.
Pleasure, Stan.
Guys, stay warm.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. Happy holidays to you. And maybe we'll talk again at some point.
You as well.
Take care, all brother.
Thanks, Stan.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You got the touch. You got the power.